Consumer Affairs to order, and Etta, thank you for filling in for us today. Appreciate it. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill, a joint hearing on House Bill 2216, 2217, and 2219. Janet, give us a summary, please.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2216 is at the request of the Department of Justice and would require contractors who provide improvements at manufactured dwelling parks to comply with contractor bidding statutes and would include a manufactured dwelling subdivision in provisions that are related to such contracting and to existing disclosure requirements that now apply to manufactured dwelling parks. The trio that's going to come up and talk about these bills will distinguish for you between manufactured dwelling parks and manufactured dwelling subdivisions. They're also going to cover the 2001 Attorney General's review of all the manufactured dwelling park statutes, and these are kind of cleanup bills from those that review. Mr. Chair, on 2216, there's an amendment that should have been distributed to your office on Friday, House Bill 2216-1. And that amendment specifies that disclosure and contracting requirements apply to these manufactured dwelling subdivisions, regardless of whether the lots are located in a facility. And it restates the definition of manufactured dwelling park to include subdivisions. So the changes are on page 9. And they replace the dash 1 amendments on 2216 replace all but the last two sections of the bill. So it's mostly replacing the bill, except for sections 3 and 4 of the are still in the original bill. And House Bill 2217 specifies that manufactured dwelling park dealers or manufactured dwelling park owners that contract to make for the dwelling.
Were you on the air?
That if they make improvements to the dwelling owner's site, if they contract with a third party to make improvements, they are responsible for making sure the work is completed. That's House Bill 2217. And House Bill 2219 makes unlawful trade practices of a manufactured dwelling dealer one of the unlawful trade practices that can be prosecuted by the Attorney General. These are already unlawful trade practices that were not put in the statutes that make them able to be prosecuted by the Attorney General's office. And I think in the material on that bill, we included the statute that lists what unlawful trade practices are by a manufacturer dealer, and that's how in ORA 646-648. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Let's see. Could I have Janet referred to them as the Three Musketeers? Thank you, folks. Which way do we want to start here?
I think I'm going to start off.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
Good morning, Representative Brown and members of the committee. My name is Marilyn Odell. I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice, and I work in the consumer protection section, and I'm here today to talk to you about House Bills 2216, 2217, and 2219. These are all bills that relate to disclosures to purchasers of manufactured dwellings. Before I talk specifically about the bills, I wanted to give you some background on in this area. I'm going to give an overview, and then my cohorts here are going to give you some more specifics because they were more intimately involved in some of the developments. In September of 2000, the Attorney General convened a task force to look at manufactured housing issues. And these had come up a number of times in the consumer protection area, and it was felt that there were a number of issues that needed to be addressed more thoroughly. There was participation by a cross-section of interested parties, from industry to lenders to consumers. The group met over a year's time and developed a number of legislative proposals to address the key issues, which were the sales transactions, financing of purchases, and those disclosures, what could be included, with the idea that the buyer purchaser needed to have more information about what they were paying for, more specification, and the relationships between the tenants and the park owners. Of the recommendations that came out of that, four bills passed, and I've detailed those for you in my testimony. The first two are the most important for the bills that we have here. The first one is 2702 that required manufactured housing park landlords to disclose to prospective tenants the improvements that needed to be made to the site in the park under the rental agreement and to provide estimated costs. There are significant improvements that are typically required of the tenant in preparing these sites for the manufactured dwelling. That can include everything from sidewalks to driveways to garages to decking, as well as more infrastructure and utility hookups. This is a very substantial cost. The second bill is House Bill 3684, and that bill requires uniform disclosures to the consumer of what is the basic price of the manufactured dwelling, as well as the add-ons, and that typically would be the things like the like the park improvements that frequently get added to the financing in those situations. The next bill, 3917, made violation of these disclosures an unlawful trade practice. And finally, House Bill 3686 made it easier for a park owner to convert a mobile home park into a subdivision, and that allowed the tenant to actually purchase a lot within a converted manufactured park, so they could own their own the land under their manufactured dwelling home. Next, in December of 2001. Several of these bills had mandated rulemaking by the Department of Justice to implement these bills. Again, a cross-section of stakeholders participated in this rulemaking process. The group met eight times, refined the language, and the concept, the issues, the bills that you have here are an outgrowth of holes that were seen in the legislation that was passed. And we have those bills here for you for your consideration today. We believe those will...
And that's the advisory committee. They came out of that advisory committee?
Yes, that came out of the advisory committee.
And everyone was represented there? Huh?
Everybody was represented. It was... there were about 8 or 10 individuals that were on the advisory committee. There were park owners, there were park dealers, there was contractors, lending agencies, and state agencies that were interested in that as well, community housing, and I believe the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, ma'am. Go ahead.
Thank you. And I'd like to turn this over to Don.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. Just to distinguish myself from my good friend, Mr. Brenneman, John represents more park owners. I represent manufacturers, retailers, lenders who finance manufactured homes, suppliers who provide shingles, siding, et cetera, and land developers, but generally not park owners, although there are a number of park owners in our organization. If I could go back just a little bit also on the history of this, in the late 1990s, the manufactured housing industry just boomed, and a lot of new folks came into the business. Some of those people weren't as reputable as they should have been. They engaged in practices that had the effect of, in my view, defrauding retail consumers. People injured by that weren't just consumers. The injury extended into the banks that financed them as the consumers walked away. Manufacturers who had to lay off folks because they didn't have enough demand for their product because consumers had walked away. And so that all made the front page of the Oregonian ad nauseum. So the industry decided to clean its own house, but we needed government assistance. And in fact, we believe that a major part of the problem was brought about because of government inaction. We were regulated by the Contractors Board, DMV, Building Codes Division, and DOJ. None of them really appeared to have enough authority to take action when there was apparent wrongdoing. So our goal in supporting the 2001 legislation was to make sure that Department of Justice at least had sufficient authority to act when wrongdoing occurred. And the essence of that legislation was to require that consumers be given disclosure. What is the nature of the transaction they're entering into? And what's it going to cost? What's required of them? I don't believe there's anything in this legislation, actually, that's new. It may clarify what we intended to do in 2001, but it was certainly our intention to require that park owners and retailers disclose to consumers any improvements that they're going to have to make if they move into a manufactured home park or mobile home park, such as decks, driveways, etc., that they should know what those improvements are going to be and what they'll cost. 2219 deals more with manufactured home retailers. It prohibits retailers from misrepresenting to a consumer that he can't get a loan, a home loan, unless he buys credit life, credit disability, etc., extended warranties. Some retailers would tell consumers, you can't get a loan unless you buy this credit life product. And that wasn't true, and so we made that specifically an unlawful trade practice. We also did in 2001 prohibit dealers from making certain misrepresentations to banks. We made an unlawful trade practice for a manufactured home dealer to tell a bank that a consumer had made a cash down payment on a house when in fact that wasn't true. And I don't quite understand why, but it turned out that the way the law finally settled out, DOJ believed that the consumer had a right of action against a retailer for making those misrepresentations, but that DOJ didn't have a right to act. And remember, our premise to begin with is we think much of the problem was brought about by government inaction. So, of course, we would support 2219. It's, I think it's just a step, something we thought we had done already. After 2001, if I could just bring us a little bit forward, in the last legislature, manufactured home regulations of dealers were formally regulated by the Department of Motor Vehicles. In 2003, that authority has been transferred to the Building Codes Division. And again, it's our goal is to sort of tighten it up a little bit, make sure that there is government oversight of this industry. In this legislature and in front of this committee, we're going to bring a couple of bills, 2375 and 2376. I know it's a little bit off the mark here, but 2375 would tell Building Codes Division that they must act against a dealer if the dealer uses a purchase agreement that doesn't contain the disclosures required by the Department of Justice. 2376 would require that Building Codes Division act against a dealer if he makes those prohibited misrepresentations to a consumer. So we're trying to tie it all together here. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Brenneman. I represent the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. John and I are confused sometimes, especially with new members of the legislature, and he's right. My people rent the spaces, and he builds the homes that go on them. To add further confusion, some of you, if you've been around long enough, Representative Gilman will remember that the residents of the park used to be called the Oregon State Tenants Association, and in fact their publication you received is still called the OSTA Review. However, they've changed their name formally to the Mobile Home Owners Association to show that they're owners of mobile homes, but that has added some further confusion about whether you're renting a space, whether you own the park, and so forth. So that's the current designation. Some of us in the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition ask that these bills come before us in one of our regular sessions that we could discuss them and work on them. And the amendments that you have before you was a result of that earlier work. You're also, as things tie together, you'll also be looking at a bill coming from the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition. Don's a member. There are three landlord groups that meet in there, and then there are representatives for the residents, and the residents themselves are represented in that working group. This is about the third session where we've had a pretty good relationship and sitting down and working out through some of the tough issues. This is, in my estimation, since I've been with Manufactured Housing Communities for over 10 years now, almost 12, probably the best working relationship that you see. Those of us that were around 10 years ago can remember the demonstrations that would occur at the Capitol. They weren't really a good, friendly situation, and legislators would find a lot of heat directed toward them to do something for residents. And so we've developed over the last few sessions a very good working relationship, and we've had pretty good bills, and we trade issues. And we have turned in three issues to legislative council. That's as far as we've gotten to this point, and it'll be introduced this time in the Senate and come over to you. By the time it gets here later in the session, it'll be pretty well worked out. There may be another issue or two that we want to add to that bill over here if we get that far. We're meeting on a weekly basis, and we meet for 3 hours in the morning once a week, and we continue discussions. One of the things contained in the amendments come from that coalition to make my landlords feel more comfortable about whether they have to have a contractor's license. So if you'll see on the bottom of the testimony from Marilyn on page 3 at the bottom, we had some concerns that a dealer or landlord not have to have a contractor's license under some certain conditions. She's listed here that I might get on the record. It'll be there in the printed form, but additionally through this transcript, that the dealer landlord is not a provider if the dealer or landlord merely gives the tenant buyer a list of required improvements, that the dealer or landlord merely suggests the name of a licensed contractor, that the landlord performs landscape and other maintenance within their park. That was a particular concern to at least one of my landlords that he didn't want to do regular maintenance around the park, distribute a load of gravel, spread it out or something, and then find he needed a contractor's license. We're comfortable with these bills, with the amendments. The coalition feels comfortable. Don and I are officially representing that coalition today to say the amendments were ones that we asked be made from that coalition, and we accept them as ones that will take care of what our concerns were.
Thank you. Thank you, John. And there's one bullet point on the next page that this bill would not require a dealer or landlord to be a licensed contractor if they perform the landscape or other maintenance. And it's in the record now.
Yeah, thanks.
Is there any questions?
Chair Brown, yeah. Representative Brown, I'd like to go through each of the bills if this is the right time to do that.
This is the time to do it.
Okay. This is Marilyn O'Dell again. First bill is House Bill 2216. That bill would change the definition of manufactured dwelling park to include not only lots that are within what's known as a traditional park, as it's defined under Chapter 446, but to include lots in a subdivision, and that would be lots that are created under Chapter 92, and there's a provision for the conversion of a park into a subdivision, and that, of course, allows the individual sale of those lots, but at times those lots are also rented. This change is needed so that there's full disclosure to the tenant of any changes that they, of any improvements that they need to make. There was also a time requirement in the current statute for giving the estimate of costs. That time is stated as prior to the delivery of the home. Well, actually, the timing of that has to happen much earlier in the process. These costs are rolled into the financing, and the work has to be completed weeks before the home is ever delivered. So this bill proposes to delete the time requirement so that it happens when it's needed by the purchaser.
Janet had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's about that time requirement that's eliminated. It's not replaced by any different time requirement. Is that okay?
We felt that it was, because the time that it, when it's needed, depends on the work that needs to be done and whether it needs to be, the bid needs to be given in advance so that the buyer can get the financing. And lastly, the bill requires that the provider, as it's defined in these statutes, comply with the requirements under Chapter 701, which is the bill, which is a statute governing independent contractors, that the bid be given in compliance with that chapter. Now, that amendment becomes more important when I get to our next bill, which is 2217,
Mr. Chair,
because of the expansion of the definition of provider.
Thank you. I support all these. They're helping the retailer, the landlord, and the owner. But my question is for my own curiosity more than anything. Can you explain the improvement of this language by using the words mean and means rather than include and includes? It just jumps right out at me. Is there some?
Representative Brown, Representative Schaffler, that is strictly a Legislative Council change of language. That's what they prefer to use now. You will see in the amendments, we went back. They changed all of the definitions under 90.100 to means from includes. We went back to the original language because while it's a good goal to make some uniformity, means doesn't always work, includes sometimes the right word. So that's a general language change that Legislative Council is trying to update with all of these amendments.
I'll go ask them then. Thank you.
Question. Representative Esquivel.
Yes. Please put this in a time frame. Example, it says providers are required to provide a statement of estimated cost bids prior to the date that the manufactured dwelling is delivered to a manufactured dwelling park. In reality, the bid must be given much sooner than prior to the date the home is delivered to the park. Give me some kind of a time frame so this will fit together. Example, I go out and I get a loan, I get a package deal on an estimate. Does that mean that this estimate has to be part of the loan before the manufactured home can be ordered, or is a manufactured home ordered and then this package shows up?
Representative Brown, Representative Esquivel, typically the costs of these improvements that we call the park package are included in the initial financing. So the bid needs to be given quite early in the process before the home is actually purchased.
So it's prior to any closing documentation on a purchase?
That's my understanding, and perhaps Dawn.
Is that where we're at here?
Better answer to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, not all manufactured homes are financed. I think it's part of... Well, I'm not sure, since there's no date, no time specific in here.
See, what my concern is, I have a double wide coming, and oh, by the way, it's going to actually be $30,000 on this package instead of the estimated $20,000 that we thought. Is there any place for a buyer to have an approval of this package?
As I would read this language, it would essentially say that the consumer is not bound unless he is given this information.
But the date's what's bothering me here. It's prior to. What does that mean?
Well, there needs to be, excuse me, Chair Brown, Representative Esquivel, there would need to be an amount determined for the buyer to be liable for those improvements, and those improvements need to be completed prior to the manufactured dwelling being delivered. So as far as the timing goes, that needs to be included in a contract.
So then there's no way that I can have a manufactured home coming and then have this change.
Well, it would have to be a contract that was an agreement between the two parties to hold the buyer liable for the costs of those improvements.
Well, correct. But, I mean, I just don't want to get someone in a situation where they are bound to have a manufactured home coming and find out there's a little bit more to the package than they anticipate. So what you're saying, it's cast in stone before they ever purchase the manufactured home or before it's even ordered. This is all set in stone. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, I don't think it would work to say that this has to be cast in stone before the home is ordered. There's a couple of transactions going on when you buy a manufactured home. There is the acquisition of the home itself and the amenities contained in the home, and then there is the site improvements, the systems development charges, the building permits, the septic tanks, the garages, the sidewalk, all that stuff. You wouldn't want to say that an order for a home isn't valid until the rest of this is finalized, because that's kind of a work in progress. And those things change. You run into soft dirt. You thought there was rock and there's soft dirt. So those things can change. Before the home was delivered was a point in time when it all ought to be known. As you back up, this language gives no point in time.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Chalker.
So, if I order me a double-wide manufactured home, and it says in my agreement that I'm going to get brass fixtures, and then they come get it off the truck, and they say, oh, no, we're charging you several hundred more because you've got gold fixtures, that can't happen.
Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, what we're addressing here in this bill isn't actually the amenities that are part of the home. Rather, what we're addressing are the improvements to the site itself.
Right. I think I'm trying to get to what my colleague was talking about, which ain't in this. We're talking about, and I definitely understand that when you go build something, the land varies, the topography and all that varies. So, but I just wanted to get that squared away in my head.
Well, and what we're...
That isn't going to happen when I'm offloading the house off the truck.
It shouldn't. What we're talking about is a rental agreement that is contracted between the tenant, buyer, and the landlord. And as part of that agreement, under the current law, the landlord needs to detail all of the improvements that are required. The question is what disclosure of the price of what that includes. And if the buyer tenant themselves gets a contractor and gets all the work done, there's no issue because they're the ones that have gotten it. They're directly paying the contractor for the work. When the problem arises is really when the either the dealer or the landlord acts as a middleman in that transaction. They make the arrangements for getting the work done, and they actually pay the contractor to perform the work. And in that case, the buyer needs to know exactly what those amounts are, and that amount is agreed with them in a separate contract.
Thank you.
I don't know if I've answered the question.
No, you answered my question.
Okay.
Well, in Section 3, be line 22 through 24, that is just a statement that the provider provides an estimate, right? And it doesn't give any time frame. Right?
Are you looking at the original bill?
Yes.
Okay, let me get back to that.
It just removes, there was a time established there, delivered to the manufacturer, to the date that, prior to the date, and that just removes that and says, and just states that they will provide this estimate of cost. And then in the next one, in line 25 down, it says if they fail to do that, there's some remedy there.
Chair Brown, that's correct.
Yeah.
It only removes the specification of when that has to happen.
Right. Okay.
It still does have to happen, though.
Right. And if they fail to do it, it tells what the consequences are.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know about you, Marilyn, but I lost track where we're at.
Okay, let me move along.
Chair Brown.
Representing Holt.
I'd like to ask a question. Just in reviewing some of this, where the provider has to provide the estimated costs, and then later on in the next bill, 2217, we're defining the landlord as not being a provider for other maintenance. Does the landlord also have to provide estimated costs for some of the costs that are going to be involved with the buyer going into this agreement someplace in there? I was just kind of concerned because other maintenance, I don't see a definition for what other maintenance is that's being that allows the landlord not to be a provider. And so I'm worried about those costs. Are they some hit in here somewhere and that's addressed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, the improvements is defined specifically in Chapter 446 to include things that are part of the initial setup. It includes things like driveways, gutters, downspouts, building a basement, building a garage, hookups to utilities. It includes more of the infrastructure of the construction before that has to happen before you lay the manufactured house on. It does not address any ongoing maintenance that a landlord would perform routinely in their park. If there was some provision for those things being assessed against the tenant, that would be a completely separate agreement and would presumably be included in the rental agreement, but is not covered at all under this bill. This merely addresses that pre-installation setup and those kinds of improvements that are done as part of that.
So presumably they're covered under the agreement, is what you're saying, with the landlord?
I would think that if the landlord was charging for that kind of ongoing maintenance to the park, that there would be some sort of a monthly charge or something else, but that would be totally outside the scope of this bill.
Follow up. And to your knowledge, do we have a list of what the ongoing maintenance or other maintenance that's referred to in this bill actually is, that the landlord is not required to be a provider to perform other maintenance? Is there a definition of that somewhere else?
Representative Holby, we've only, by way of clarification, it's actually not part of the language of the bill, specified that we're only pulling in that statutory definition of improvements within the scope of this bill, and it was really the to make a record for the benefit of the other interested parties that we're not intending to in any way pull in other maintenance that might be done as part of the general upkeep of the park.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Conflict.
So I buy my double wide with the gold features, and I make a deal with the manufacturer, and I make a deal with the landlord saying you will install the gutters, the driveway, and the landscaping, but that doesn't mean that they all have to maintain it on a monthly basis. That's kind of where we're at here. Am I getting this squared away?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, that's right. The maintenance would have nothing to do with this particular bill. I assume that there might be something else under the rental agreement that
right.
would probably specify who performs those, whether it's the tenant or the landlord.
So they install all that, but it would be a separate contract outside of this that would be for the cleaning of my gutters, the power washing of my driveway, and the mowing of my lawn.
And if you can get your landlord to do that, that would be a pretty good deal.
I do that for
That's correct. I assume those are that kind of maintenance that's more affected to the house, the dwelling itself, or probably the tenant's obligation
in
most circumstances.
Okay. Well, go
okay.
ahead.
If I move along, I think that's all I have on...
The 2216? 2216.
I guess let me just say
the dash. Did you want to speak to the dash one?
Yes, I think that's what I probably should do. The dash one amendments are fairly technical. Chapter 90 addresses specifically landlord-tenant relationships. The first half of Chapter 90 has to do with what you call non-facility rentals. And the second half of Chapter 90 addresses facility rentals. Because the definition of manufactured dwelling park for purposes of Chapter 90 includes both facilities and non-facilities. The coalition recommended that we add a cross-reference in the non-facility section of Chapter 90, which is the 90 in ORS 90.120, that it includes this definition as well. Only for purposes of these regulations. So this is a technical cross reference that doesn't have any substantive effect. except that it makes it clear that it applies to both kinds of rentals, because both kinds of rentals are included in the expanded definition of manufactured dwelling park under the bill.
Thank you.
On page 9, line 11 through 16, talks about if the subdivision was approved by the local government, when would it not be approved by the local government? When would there be an example of when there's a subdivision that is not approved by a local government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, we were just that merely just cross-references that it's a duly authorized subdivision created by law versus some, I suppose, informal, unauthorized division of land.
Mark, so may I? But we're not in any way allowing anybody to put up a subdivision without it being approved by local government. That's my really what I...
Correct. That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
That's correct. And this added part of the definition is really taken from what was excluded under Chapter 446. So we just, instead of having the negative, put in the positive of the language in that
okay.
section.
Thank you.
Any other question? Thank you.
And the balance of the amendments are to correct the reversion back to original statutory language using includes as opposed to means. So we've gone back to that original language. If it's not broken, don't fix it approach. Okay. Next, I'd like to speak to 2217 is just a companion bill to 2216. The only thing it does is it expands the definition of provider for purposes of the disclosures that are necessary regarding improvements. And the reason that's needed, I think I covered a little bit, but what happens frequently in these transactions is either the dealer or the landlord are actually the party who contracts with the contractor to get these improvements done. And in that case, the tenant has no contractual relationship, which means no recourse against the contractor if the work isn't performed. The tenant, though, has already paid for the work, because typically that payment is in advance or maybe even included, as we discussed, in the financing. So it's important for the tenant to have recourse against the landlord or the dealer, who is actually the contracting party who can go after the bond if the contractor fails to perform as required. So that's what this bill does. It adds the landlord and the dealer to the parties that could be providers if they are the ones contracting to make those improvements. Again, this doesn't require the dealer landlord to become a licensed contractor, or if they're acting merely as the middleman in this transaction. But it does require them, as I indicated, under 2216, to comply with the bid requirements under the concession contractors laws. And that's where the intersection of these two bills is very important.
Mr. Chair. I was just going to get something on the record here. My first reading of lines 11 and 12, which are the changes to House Bill 2217, to me it sounded like the buyer was the one making the improvements, not a third party. But we've talked to legislative council and to these three, and I guess it's understood that it's not the buyer that's making the improvements, but it is a third party for the land, either the landlord or the dealer.
Duly noted. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I don't want to, you know, drag this out too much, but I'm still trying to grasp when the manufacturer, dwelling dealer, or landlord contracts with the buyer to make improvements and, you know, subs it out to some other licensed contractor, you're saying that under those circumstances that dealer or landlord is not a provider and does not need a contractor's license? Is that, am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, that's my understanding. I think that Mr. Miner may disagree with me and that about whether the dealer landlord would need to have a contractor's license. I think it's been our view that if they're merely acting as the middleman in the transaction, that that does not require them to be a contractor. But under this bill, we would require them to comply with the bid requirements for contractors.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I would disagree. I believe that a person who serves as a middle person, middleman, is required to be a construction contractor because that person is the one who is in privity with the buyer. And so I think that's fundamental to the system, is that, that if a park owner provides or arranges for decks to be built for a consumer, and the consumer has an agreement with that park owner, that park owner must be a construction contractor, just as a dealer, if the dealer on behalf of the consumer arranges for a person to install the home, the dealer is required to be a construction contractor. I think that's what has always been envisioned here. Otherwise, the consumer would have no recourse because he wouldn't have a contract with the subcontractor, so would have no mechanism. There'd be no mechanism to go off after him. There'd be no bond. There'd be.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I got to say that I agree with Mr. Miner in this case and not with the agency. I can understand that the dealer landlord who is not providing improvements but merely providing other maintenance is not a contractor. I'm okay with that as long as we're very clear on what I guess what other maintenance means is that it's not an improvement and it's covered under ORS 646. But that if I just really want to make sure that we're clear what this law does, that the dealer landlord, when he contracts with the buyer to do improvements, and I don't care if he's a middleman or somebody else, they're the ones that have the contract with the buyer, and if he wants to sub that out to a contractor, that does not relieve the responsibility or the legal connection between the landlord who is doing contracting for these improvements and the buyer. It seems to me they'd have to be a general contractor to do that or have a contractor's license to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I'd just go a little bit further. If the park owner does nothing more than say to the buyer, prospective tenant, you must have a deck that is 10 by 10 made of cedar, I don't think that makes him a contractor. If he says, here's a list of some folks in this area who build cedar decks, that doesn't make him a contractor. It's when he takes that next step and arranges for the work to be done that the consumer becomes obliged to the park owner to pay for that work when it's done. He's a contractor at that point. And I think that's long established law in the state.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Brandon again, representing MHCO, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. Our members operate, should operate, under an understanding of the law on contracting the way Mr. Miner just laid it out. And I still have some park owners that are putting new homes in new spots, and when they're doing that work and when they're making the arrangements, they have a full understanding that they need a contractor's license.
Thank you, John.
Follow up. Mr. Chair, well, I just want to make sure that this bill that we're going to pass doesn't allow the opposite of that scenario, that it for basically leaves the door open for that landlord or not to have a contractor's license. So I want to make sure that's very clear in this bill. I mean, you say that, you know, your understanding of it and your tenants agree that they understand it, that they should have contractor's license to perform that. I want to make sure this bill doesn't legally allow them not to have that contractor's license.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holden, John Brenneman again. I believe that what we're presenting with the amendments doesn't preclude the necessity of having a contractor's license when you need one. What Mr. Miner pointed out, his interpretation, when you don't need one, that you're making some recommendations and so forth, that's the kind of issues that we want covered in the record that would not make us have a license if you were doing just what was outlined in those exceptions that were listed by Marilyn earlier, that I took pains to get in the record on recommendations on maintenance, regular maintenance. That's, we want to make it perfectly clear that our members don't have to have a contracting license to do the basics.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Esco, first amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think the thing here, and I agree with what both of you have just said, I think what we need to remember is that we have a law out here that requires you, if you step over that line and start doing contractor business, then you're liable for a different law. It has nothing to do with this law. It's over here, and if you take the steps and you are a contractor, then you've stepped over that line. If you don't have a license, then the state, you will be accountable to the state. So, therefore, I think there's a set of laws in place that specifically outline an individual that does not possess a contractor's license, but does actually do contractor's work. Is that correct? Pretty much sums it up.
I think so. John Brandman, I believe you're right.
Three nodding heads. Representative Shumford.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying not to make you guys earn your money any more than you have to today, but... You know, I mean, when I look at this, it defines a provider in A, under Section 1A, Line 9, a contractor license under the ORS Chapter 701, that would be a contractor, licensed contractor, or, I mean, a manufacturing dwelling dealer or landlord that contracts with a buyer. Now, I think that is opening a door here. And I don't know. If I'm a dealer or a landlord, and I'm going to set this somebody's nice house up on it, according to this, I don't need a contractor's license to contract with that home buyer to do a whole bunch of work. That's what I'm reading here, and I don't know if I'm comfortable with that either.
Let's be quite frank with you.
Representative Shumford, I've wondered whether the bill we needed this bill. I believe that DOJ does believe that we need it, and so I don't want to take issue with that. But I've always thought that the sub a contractor, basically that means a dealer who acts as a contractor, that means a park owner who acts as a contractor, that means Mrs. Smith, the first grade teacher at my son's elementary school, who acts as a contractor. It means any person who acts as a contractor is a provider, and the definition of contractor in 701 I don't have it on my top of my head, but it's a person or undertakes or offers to undertake or submits a bid, etc. I mean, it is a very, very extensive laundry list. I don't believe there's any intention here in sub B to allow them to opt to carve out an exception that you could be a provider without being a contractor. I don't think that's the intention. While on one side of my brain, I think that bill may not be necessary. On the other side, I think that by saying manufacturer, dealer, and landlord, that you serve notice that landlords who probably aren't generally intimately familiar with the construction contractor laws of the state, it gives them notice. So I think the bill, in that sense, serves a good purpose. But again, I don't believe there's any intention to carve out.
Yeah, Chair Brown, there certainly wasn't any intention to carve this out. This came out of our rulemaking process, the advisory committee, and it was in the rulemaking process, there was an issue of making more specific requirements that addressed the dealer and the landlords. And as I recall from looking through the file, because I wasn't involved in it, there was an inquiry to legislative counsel about including that language within the rules and whether that was within our grant of rulemaking authority. And I believe the advice back to us, to DOJ, from legislative counsel was that that was not within the scope of the law and that we needed to amend the law if we wanted to include those parties, the dealers and the landlords, within the scope of this particular requirement.
Mr. Chair, I think I want to make sure that we all understand this, and me especially. What we're dealing with here is several contracts. When we say contracts, we're dealing with a manufacturer or a lender, a manufactured dealer, a rental agreement, and a construction contractual agreement. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So we're talking, when we say contracts, this could be a rental contract, it could be a purchasing contract or a sales agreement, or it could be a contractual agreement to put the infrastructure in order to achieve that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, I think generally there are those four kinds of contracts, but this particular contract under this particular regulation really is addresses the agreement to perform the construction work. This is the one piece that we're talking about in this piece is to perform the construction work itself.
Correct, but what I'm saying here is that when we talk about contracts, we could be talking about one of four.
You're correct.
Okay.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. So the dealer or the landlord that's contracting with a buyer, if that dealer or landlord does not have a contractor's license, yet they are going to make a profit on this deal, aren't they then really a contractor without a license making money? And if so, is that what we're allowing here? And if it's not what we're allowing here, then tell me. And I'm not against this idea. I understand you want to clarify the law. But isn't that then the scenario I spelled out, isn't that by definition making that individual a contractor, a construction contractor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, you may well be correct. And I think that was the problem. That was one of the reasons why these disclosure statements came up in the first place, is because the dealer or the landlord who was making these arrangements was taking a cut, adding some amount to that, and the tenant buyer didn't know that was a cost that was added in, and so what this requires is a full disclosure of what those costs are, so they can make an informed decision.
Thank you.
Representative Holden.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm, you know, going down this same road. I'm just having a lot of trouble with this B section of, you know, the provider in 2217. You know, I'd be a lot more comfortable with the language if it said manufactured dwelling dealer or landlord in compliance with ORS Chapter 701 contracts with a buyer to make improvements. I'd be a lot more comfortable with that, and that sort of puts the dwelling dealer and the landlord on notice that they need to be in compliance with the construction contractor laws when they contract to do improvements. Otherwise, it seems kind of vague, and it does sort of open the door for interpretation on whether the dwelling dealer or landlord needs to be in compliance with ORS Chapter 701.
So you're talking about adding after contracts, you add under ORS Chapter 701. Is that where you said to add it?
After landlord, I would add in compliance with ORS Chapter 701 contracts with the buyer. I mean, I'm not a lawyer or wordsmith here, but however you make that point legally, according to legislative counsel, I just think that you need to reference that the dealer or the landlord needs to be in compliance with the contracting laws when they actually contract to do improvements. And I don't think anybody would have an objection with that. I just would like to see that clarification. From everything I've heard, everybody agrees with that. So why don't we just make that a little clearer, I think.
Don?
Mr. Chair, another way to accomplish that might be to on line 10 after the word or, assuming it sounds like this bill is going to be amended, so I don't just say substitute the word or and just make it one sentence, including a manufactured dwelling dealer or landlord that contracts with, which gets about the same place.
Very close.
Yeah, either way is fine with me. Just, I'd just like to make it clear. That
Mr.
Song.
Chair, including or meaning. I'm sorry, I'm just...
the term provider could be larger than the Don Minor for your record, the dealer or landlord. It's...
Yeah,
joking.
It
could be anybody.
Sorry about that.
But again, there is no intention, although I see that it could be seen in the language. It might be implicit in the language that there is another class of persons who could contract without being...
And Mr. Chair, and my concern is, if we're going to do that, and then somebody... I'm confident all the park owners are great folks, but you know what? Just in case one moves in from somewhere else and isn't, and then they contract out and they don't got a bond or any insurance, and then this homeowner's stuck with a big bill, it's all screwed up, and then they come back and ask me why I voted for that. So I share the concerns being voiced here by the committee, and I would like to see it amended, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I think that the committee has made some valid points, and it looks like we should revisit that language and make it clear, as long as everyone's clear that in agreement that the manufactured dwelling dealer and landlord does need to be a contractor, then I think the language could be more clear, and we would certainly not want that to take them outside of those requirements.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll go to LCA and get some amendments drafted to help clarify that thing. And so let's move on to the next one.
Okay. The next bill is 2219. As Janet explained, this is the regarding the law that makes it an unlawful trade practice for a manufactured dwelling dealer to make certain misrepresentations concerning financing. Now, this bill is one I think I can honestly say was a complete oversight. It was a very unusual thing that was done, totally contrary to the statutory scheme for every other unlawful trade practice in the state of Oregon. There is a laundry list of violations that are actionable, and those are contained in 646-608. I mean, there must be 50 of them. And every single one, except for this one, is in that list. All of those are actionable by the Attorney General and the District Attorney.
that are in 608. Then you have ORS 646-638, and that the purpose of that statute is to define how private parties have a right of action. And it says they have a right of action for what's listed in 608, which is the same list for the Attorney General and district attorneys. It says they have a right of action for what's in 608 and what's in the manufactured housing violation section, which is 648. We are suggesting that the reference in 638 be removed and that it be added to 608, which I think was clearly the intent originally to make it actionable by both. There was no intent to create an anomaly in this area of the law, so this is really just creating an oversight for how it was originally drafted. Certainly, action by the Attorney General or the District Attorney is important in most of these areas because the cost to a private party to litigate this is great, and it allows where there's a practice that's more widespread, it allows that to be addressed in a consolidated manner. So that is the essence of what that is.
Mr. Chair?
Janet?
On Section 3, if you're looking for the change, it's in line 9, just by removing that reference to 648.
Removing, yes, 648. Okay.
Adding. So it's deleting 4, the word "or" in the statute, and then adding this one. This is totally deleting.
Okay, is there any questions? Everyone see it on page 6? Don't see any questions. There must be.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to make sure, I know that this is probably fairly simple, but 60, we're taking out 648 and leaving in 608. So I guess what you're saying is 608 covers 648 already?
Well, no, we've also, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, we've added it to 608. So in taking it out of 638, we've added it to 608, which is the laundry list of the 50 or so.
That's where I was trying to get to.
Violations.
Okay, any other questions? I don't see any more. Thank you. Not sure we went all through it. Is there any questions at all on any of those? Any more questions? Seeing none, I think we're done with that. And then we'll work on some amendments for 2217. And I think I'll wait and bring them all back for a work session when we get the amendments to that one at the same time.
Thank you,
Mr. All right, thank you, folks, for your testimony. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 2216, 2217, take the pencil out, and 2219? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2216, 2217, and 2219, and open a work session to introduce some drafts as committee bills. Certainly, Janet.
I just wanted to point out we did not route one of these to your offices because it's 165 pages and we thought we'd save a little bit of paper. So we did not wrap LC 1357. If you want to wait and introduce it and take a look at it at a different meeting, we could do that, but we decided not to wrap this one.
1357.
LC 1357.
Tell us in 10 words or less what it is.
What is that?
Yeah, I don't have it.
You notice Don Miner just left the room. This is his bill. This is from the Oregon Manufactured Housing Association, and it would convert the Manufactured Structures and Parks Advisory Board to a separate agency. It's now with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and this would make a separate agency that would deal with manufactured parks and manufactured structures.
Mr. Chair, you want to
write all that?
Yes, and these are a variety of bills, and they deal with maritime pilots and construction issues. And anyway, again, the adoption of these bills as committee bills does not reflect any support or opposition to the bills on your part.
Can we do them all at once?
One motion. Yeah, one motion.
Mr. Chair, I move we accept LC 1357, 1067, 251, and 1539 as committee bills.
Representative Schaffer moves that we introduce LC 1539, 1067, 251, and 1357 as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, they are adopted as committee bills. Janet?
Mr. Chair, two bills on our Wednesday's agenda, House Bill 2181 and 2180. One deals with elevators, and one deals with a number of licenses for trades. One of them's a large bill. If they're going to be amended, amendments are being worked on, not before Wednesday, but we'll have the hearings on Wednesday. They're set for hearings only. But I'm not going to spend a lot of time analyzing the bills as they are, and the sponsors of the bill have said don't spend a lot of time reading the bills as they are, because they're going to be enough amendments to them. So we may not even do a preliminary staff or summary on them. But we will hear what the intent is of the bills and what they're going to work on with amendments. So I just wanted to, not spend a lot of time ahead of time on those.
Mr. Chair, we're not going to have to vote on them that day, then.
Not like 2014.
Okay, anything else, Jim? And I don't know whether we told the committee about wanting to do the field trip to Portland.
And I can't remember if they talked about it or not, but to set up a committee hearing or informational hearings at the Bureau of Labor and Industry Building, and then also take a tour of one of the apprenticeships schools up there in the same day.
Mr. Chair, when we do that, they're just excused. We're not counted as an absence, though, right?
No, you'll be excused.
Okay. Because I don't want to mess up my batting average.
Talk to Butler, make sure I can get out in the afternoon.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the order? We are adjourned.